round for his suitcase and saw the overturned trolley across the street. Taduk made his way through the panic-stricken crowds toward his suitcase. People were running in all directions trying to find out what had happened. Sirens were sounding everywhere. When Taduk returned with the trolley and his suitcase, the bellboy was on his feet but looking around in shock.
"Are you okay now? Look, I've got your trolley. Come on then, back to work."
"Was it a bomb, sir?"
"Yes, I'm afraid it was."
"Where?"
"I really don't know, but we'll soon find out. It must have been very near."
"Is anybody dead?"
"I don't know that either."
Taduk led the boy into the lobby, both of them trying to avoid stepping on the shattered glass. There, they found total chaos and no receptionist. Several guests were attending to their wounds using their pristine white handkerchiefs. Taduk looked around. What was he to do now? It was then that he noticed his pants were torn at the knees. "Damn it," he mumbled. His new suit was ruined. He decided to go upstairs and just find a vacant room. He went along the corridor trying one door after another. The first three were locked. The fourth opened, but there were some belongings scattered around and the beds weren't made up. He tried another door on the opposite side. Luckily, this one was vacant. The beds were made and the cupboards empty. Taduk closed the door, opened his suitcase on the bed, and took out his old gray suit. In the bathroom, he took all the glass out of his hair and freshened up. A little while later, he went back down to the lobby wearing his gray suit. The receptionist was there, talking in an agitated manner to the guests.
"You weren't here when I arrived, so I was obliged to find myself a room. Here's the key," Taduk said.
"I'm Taduk Arıca from Ankara. I believe the foreign ministry has reserved my room."
The receptionist looked confused. He stared briefly at Taduk and took the key without saying a word. It was obvious that he was still in shock.
"Have you been able to find out what happened?" Taduk asked.
"Apparently a bomb exploded at the Pera Palace Hotel nearby. 6 people are dead and there are many wounded,"
replied the receptionist.
"Dead?"
"I understand the British ambassador to Sofia is on a visit to Istanbul. They say he has come to see İnönü. I wonder if there is a connection. Maybe it was an attempt to kill him."
"You mean Mr. Randall?"
"Oh, you know him, do you?"
asked the receptionist in amazement.
"No, I don't, but I know of him. Is he dead?"
The man knocked on wood.
"Those working behind the reception desk were killed, but apparently the ambassador had just walked into the bar a few minutes before, and he's safe and sound."
Taduk walked out of the hotel and down the street toward the Pera Palace Hotel. Policemen were trying to disperse the crowd in front of the hotel, while nurses and doctors, stumbling over uprooted paving stones and twisted tram lines, carried the wounded to waiting ambulances. Squeezing through the crowd, Taduk approached a group of young men. He assumed they were journalists as they were busy taking photographs. He asked one of them how it had happened.
"It seems the bomb was placed in a suitcase in the lobby."
Who was the bomb meant for? Taduk wondered. He thought probably the British ambassadors, Randall and Hugesson, the ambassador to Turkey. Taduk couldn't help feeling sorry for the poor souls who had been behind the reception desk, not to mention the innocent commuters who had just been going about their daily business. The taxi driver's words came back to him.
"Who knows when their number's up?"
Marseille, 1940-41. Selva poured herself a cup of hot coffee, breathing in the aroma, thinking how interesting it was that human nature adapts itself to all sorts of situations. When she and Rafo had first settled in France, she hated this bitter coffee served in these huge cups. Fortunately, Sabiha, or rather Majid, had managed to bring her many packages of tea, plus 6 dainty Turkish tea glasses. Majid had visited France quite often in those days. It was such a joy to drink that Turkish tea at breakfast with Rafo. After the birth of their son, Selva got used to this bitter coffee. She drank it to keep herself awake until the baby's last feeding at night. What had begun as a way of keeping herself awake had turned into an addiction. Rafo couldn't understand how she could drink this poison. In fact, there were a number of things Rafo couldn't get used to here in France.
"For goodness sake, don't criticize things in front of other people,"
she'd said when he first expressed his lack of enthusiasm.
"They'll think you are a peasant. Fancy not enjoying the best cuisine in the world."
"I don't care what they think. The best cuisine in the world is Turkish. What do I care if they are ignorant?"
Rafo insisted.
"I will never understand how on earth French food has this great reputation. Those heavy sauces play havoc with your digestion, and just the thought of swallowing snails makes me want to throw up. And as for that cheese that smells like sweaty feet..."
Selva tried to get him to stop, but he wouldn't give up.
"Is there anything to beat the flavor of fresh vegetables cooked in olive oil, for instance? Can you tell me how they justify ruining the flavor of beautiful fish by smothering it in all those sauces?"
"Why on earth have we come here, then, if you hate the food so much?"
"Because their wines are absolutely magnificent."
"That may be, but we can't afford them, can we?"
Selva reminded him.
"We will, my darling, we will. Trust me, be a little patient. Look how well we've budgeted this month. If we can stick to this for a few more months, we will be able to afford all the best wines in the country."
If Rafo hadn't been able to fulfill that promise, Selva would not have been very upset. But as it happened, just as Rafo had achieved his aim, everything turned upside down. Selva was sitting at the dining table helping their neighbor's daughter Yvonne with her English homework, when suddenly they heard a commotion outside. Both rushed to the window. Yvonne, who was only 9, was so excited to see all the policemen on their motorcycles that she started to clap. Sitting stiff-backed on the motorcycles, they looked like statues. Selva immediately felt as though a desperate bird were fluttering in her heart. She put her hand on her huge tummy and prayed,
"Please, God, protect our child."
As soon as Yvonne left, Selva rushed across the street to the pharmacy where Rafa worked, and when she saw his pale face, she felt she might miscarry. But she didn't, and the baby was born 1 month later, 2 weeks prematurely, a tiny son. They called the boy Fazul, after her father. Not that she hadn't worried about her father's objections to a Jew's son having his name. Even though she was still angry with him, she put those worries to the back of her mind because she still loved and missed him so much. They had decided that should the baby be a boy, they would have him circumcised after 7 days, according to Jewish tradition. However, because of the ominous Nazi presence, they decided against it. The day Rafo made this decision, he hadn't been able to sleep all night. Selva would sip her coffee and go through the accounts in her notebook. They were in a mess. By the time the Germans occupied the north of France and Paris, Selva and Rafo had already left for Marseille. They had hoped they would be safe there, but events had taken an unexpected turn. Marshal Pétain, who had taken over the Vichy government and declared himself president, had decided to cooperate with the Germans in order to prevent the rest of the country from being occupied. In his effort not to step on the Germans' toes, he had begun to accede to their every demand. The Vichy police even started to hunt down the Jews. De Gaulle, who had opposed any collaboration, had fled to Britain to form his Free French forces. Unfortunately, neither the underground resistance nor De Gaulle in Britain could do much to help the Jews. Selva lost 2 of her students when their Jewish parents decided to leave the area, but that turned out to be a blessing in disguise. Other parents who were planning to escape to America wanted Selva to teach their children. So she immediately had 3 new students and had to turn others away. She was happy to have more students, but Rafa warned her to be cautious.
"For God's sake, Selva, be careful. The fascists are all over the place. They are bound to notice these youngsters coming and going."
"What's wrong with teaching English, Rafa? Is it forbidden to teach?"
"No, but it is forbidden to be Jewish."
Selva became more and more frustrated each day. She hadn't been able to forgive her father, because he looked down on people who were of a different faith. He, in turn, hadn't forgiven his daughter for his own reasons, probably mainly because his daughter had rebelled against his wishes. Selva had never wanted to believe that her father had opposed her marriage solely on religious grounds. She couldn't believe that the man she respected and loved so much was a religious bigot. What was all this fuss about religion? Surely, she thought, religion should be practiced without thought of race or color, with all its ceremonies carried out in mosques, churches, and synagogues. God was worshipped in these communities, and people reached out to him and found peace in their souls. Selva recalled the joy of Ramadan back home, the excitement of preparing the evening meals before breaking the fast, the special care not to miss prayers, the serenity of the older members of the household in their white headscarves before they prayed, the aura of mystery surrounding the muezzin's call. All these were exciting. Yes, religion was a many-splendored thing. Surely it should be part of life and not used to separate people. Couldn't people from different religions love one another? "Oh, dearest father," she thought, "is religion worth sacrificing your daughter? Is it worth rejecting your son-in-law just because he prays in a synagogue?" Selva could well remember the debate she'd had with her father on the subject. In those days, Fazıl Reşat Paşa had no idea of what was to come. He too enjoyed having philosophical discussions with his daughter, that clever girl who willingly read every book he suggested. Later, they discussed them in detail for hours on end. The Pasha had often pointed out that the more people became interested in science, the pursuit of knowledge and culture, the less importance they placed on religion. He often told his daughter that most bigots or fanatics came from poor, ignorant backgrounds. Even during the time when Selva was falling madly in love with Rafa, she had discussed these issues with her father in depth. Respect for other religions? Of course! It is one of the conditions of being contemporary. What about being enlightened by other religions? Why, after all, was Fazıl Reşat Paşa giving Selva books to read about Far Eastern religions? Wasn't it because he wanted his daughter to understand not everybody was alike? There were those who didn't think the same. It was up to her to draw her own conclusions. She had hoped to use her father's own views to defend herself regarding Rafa. She would remind him of his every word. But sadly, when he learned of the romance, he put up a brick wall, simply saying,
"Over my dead body. You cannot marry him. I won't give my permission."
At first, Selva kept asking why. Even though her father was an open-minded person, he opposed a marriage that would go against his customs, his traditions. Dismayed, she soon found out that he had provided his daughters with a good education for his own reason. It wasn't to broaden their horizons, but so they'd raise good Muslim grandchildren for him. Finally, she had to compromise.
"Fine, if that's the way it must be. I certainly won't marry anyone else. Not one of Macit's friends at the ministry or the son of some pasha. It will have to be Raphael or no one."
Rafa seemed resigned to his fate. He was more concerned about the problems they might encounter than Selva was herself. What would be the reaction of his friends and family? How would he provide for this girl who was used to nothing but the best? Those were responsibilities he would have to shoulder. Selva wrote to Rafo during the time she spent with her sister in Ankara. Not love letters, but those of a friend. While she was there, Selva took the opportunity to observe those around her. Those in her sister's circle were mostly people who had made good marriages. What she'd learned from this experience was that if people chose to marry partners from a similar background, they stood a better chance that the relationship would last after their early passion waned, especially after their children were born. When she returned to Istanbul, Selva realized that none of the young men she'd been introduced to were of interest. She felt nothing for any of the young diplomats she had met through her brother-in-law. She wasn't just being stubborn. She simply had nothing in common with these young men. In her opinion, they were only interested in themselves, and, dictated by their mothers, they were looking for suitable wealthy debutantes to marry. None of them made her smile, much less roam the streets with her happily and aimlessly. They only wanted to take her dancing at the Ankara Palace after the receptions. Putting their arms around her waist, they waltzed in their squeaky patent leather shoes. Some tried to kiss her, merely touching her lips with their own, and she felt nothing. She was bored. Back at Sabiha's house, she lay on her bed in her young niece's bedroom. She looked up at the shadows thrown onto the ceiling by the streetlights outside. She had only one life to live. Did they expect her to waste it? Her father was behaving totally against his nature, and in so doing, poisoning her life. She would not be able to marry, or to be happy, or to know the love of a child. In short, she wouldn't be able to live her life. Why? Because Fazıl Reşat Paşa said so. Because of what their relatives, friends, and neighbors would say. Was what people thought more important than her happiness? No. With these thoughts, she decided to send word to Rafo and ask if he still wanted her. Rafo certainly did want her, but at the same time, he was reluctant to disrupt her life. He was scared of not being able to offer her the life to which she was accustomed. Since his own family would renounce him too, they would have to live on what he could earn. Was Selva ready for this? He urged her to wait and think carefully about her decision. He didn't want her to have regrets later. Selva had thought about all of this when she was sent to stay with her uncle in Cyprus, and decided she was willing to take the risk. She was willing to face the problems ahead, to live in a foreign country far from her family, even to make do with little money. She had thought about everything and had answers for every question. She hadn't discussed it with Rafo because she was sure that she knew his answer. She knew Rafo wanted her just as much as she wanted him. After she spent that difficult year in Cyprus, Selva's mind was made up, and she informed Rafo of her decision. She was, however, taken aback to find out that Sabiha, who had been her confidant and staunch supporter, had changed her tune. Hadn't she initially encouraged her relationship with Rafo? Now she spent hours, until early in the morning, trying to make her change her mind, as if she hadn't been instrumental in helping Selva's clandestine meetings with Rafo. "How could I have known that you'd be crazy enough to let things go so far?" Sabiha kept saying. "How could I have known that you would fall in love, let alone want to marry him? Never! It never entered my mind!" And what of her father? Her father she had loved and respected above all others her entire life. He had even attempted suicide, hoping that she would change her mind. In fact, as far as Selva was concerned, that was the point of no return. "Let's run away from here as soon as possible, Rafo," she said. "Let's go somewhere with different values that aren't so extreme. Let's run away from our family's emotional blackmail." Finally, they left. But now the torment they had endured in Istanbul seemed nothing in comparison to the humiliation and suffering the Germans inflicted on the Jews. The Germans, with their steely eyes and hard expressions, were putting the Jews in France through hell. Selva loathed them, and she wondered how Rafo felt deep down inside. Just as Selva was checking the additions in her accounts book, she heard the footsteps of the postman. He delivered a couple of bills and a letter from Sabiha. She closed the accounts book and poured herself a fresh cup of coffee. Sitting in the armchair in front of the window, stretching her legs on the footstool, she tore open the letter. The best minutes of her day were about to begin. Before young Fazl woke up, she would have about an hour to devour the letter's every word and dream of the old country. Her sister wrote about someone called Taruk. She vaguely remembered that name. Yes, that's right. Sabiha had mentioned him once before. Taruk had now been posted to France and was due to arrive very soon. Apparently she'd sent some money with him, and she gave instructions that Selva should call him if she ran into trouble. Selva wondered, for goodness sake, am I supposed to call this Taruk for the smallest problems? What if we need to escape? What is she going on about? Escape? Run away to where? Haven't we already run away? Haven't we escaped from all our friends' anger and gossip? Our neighbors? Even our butchers' nasty looks? Where on earth are we supposed to run to this time? Are we never going to find peace? It's as if those that didn't allow us to finish university have donned Nazi uniforms and followed us here. Anyway, Julia did very well at school. Mother, father, and Sabiha attended the end-of-term ceremony, although Majid was again too busy at the ministry to attend. It appears the change of air has really improved father's health. He is much more relaxed in Ankara. Relaxed, thought Selva. Of course. No one knows him in Ankara. Nobody points him out as the man whose daughter ran off with a Jew. Mother, too, has benefited from the dry Ankara air. She has no more asthma attacks, for one thing. Since father is more relaxed, he helps her as well. The poor woman carries a photograph of little Fazl with her wherever she goes. Well, Selva decided, at least father has not objected to my calling my son after him. Who knows? Maybe one day. Suddenly there were loud noises outside in the street. Selva jumped up to the window to see what was going on, knocking her coffee cup to the floor with a crash. Young Fazl woke up and started to cry. Two people were running after a man, overturning everything in their way. A woman was screaming at the top of her voice. Selva wiped up the spilled coffee and put the letter away before going in to check on Fazl. "Don't cry, my baby," she said. "I know your father doesn't like us going out, but we both need some fresh air." Selva seldom left the apartment. Rafo tried to protect her from all the dreadful things that were happening in the streets, and he continually created all sorts of pretexts to keep her indoors. He even came home for lunch to stop his wife from coming to him. He was adamant that she should be safe, adapting to their new life in France and bringing up a new baby. The streets of Marseille were getting more alarming, more depressing. It hadn't been easy for them to sever themselves from the easygoing, comfortable lives they had led with their families in Istanbul. But they had both chosen to change their lives to be together. They were both trying hard to adjust. It had almost been like changing their identities. Selva was no longer Fazl Reshat Pasha's spoiled little girl who lived in a mansion during the winter and a villa by the sea in the summer. She was no longer the rich girl who wore couturier dresses and was admired by all. She was now simply the wife of a Jewish apprentice chemist. Rafo hadn't been able to get his French citizenship and was therefore unable to register his partnership at the pharmacy legally. He had completed the papers, but due to the collaborationist Vichy regime, Rafo decided with his business partner to postpone the idea of citizenship for the time being. Rafo was the middle son of the Alfandari family, highly respected not only in their own community, but also in the wider Istanbul medical community. Four generations of the Alfandaris had served as palace physicians. Rafo's mother's greatest wish was that he should follow the family tradition and become a chemist. Giving up his studies for Selva had shattered her dream. Not only was Rafael Alfandari no longer a Turkish Jew, he wasn't even a French one. Furthermore, his decision not to circumcise his son had put his Jewishness in doubt. Rafo had ended up without identity, country, or religion. Yes, undoubtedly he loved Selva, but he had never foreseen burning all his bridges. Neither he nor Selva had actually wanted this, and he wondered how on earth they had found themselves in this position. When he met Selva, Rafo would still have been considered a youth. He was a student, wearing a school uniform. The tall girl who had joined his class was very different from all the other girls, had drawn his attention, and they had become friends. One day he had been invited for tea at the girl's mansion. Oh, how proud and excited his mother was. She starched his shirt and pressed his pants herself. Her son certainly couldn't go to tea empty-handed. Should he take chocolates or flowers? When he came home, she bombarded him with questions. Was the inside as opulent as the outside? Were the Pasha and his wife at home? Had Rafo met them? How many guests were there? What did they have for tea? Were the pastries from Le Bon or were they homemade? Did they have tea or soft drinks? Who had actually served the tea? Later, Rafa was invited to the grand mansion again. And then to other places. He had started to follow Selva like a shadow. Selva, the girl with the blonde plaits on top of her head. Selva, the calm girl with the big brown eyes, who always looked a little perplexed, but whose whole face lit up when she laughed. The girl who not only had a lot to say for herself, but could also listen attentively. Selva's relationship with Sabiha changed the summer that her sister got engaged. They would leave the summer villa on one of the prince's islands in the Sea of Marmara and take the ferry to the European side of Istanbul. There Sabiha and Selva would go to a cafe in Pera to meet Majid. Rafo would join them a little later. Rafo and Selva would leave the engaged couple and venture off into the side streets. On one occasion, they even hopped on a tram and crossed the Karakoy Bridge over the Golden Horn, going on to Eyüp to visit the Eyüp Sultan Mosque. Once there, they wandered around the cemetery reading interesting verses on the tombstones. Another time they walked along the Golden Horn as far as the Feshane Pier. They had really enjoyed exploring the Greek quarter at Fener. Rafo had also taken Selva to Tatavla, where all the Greek tavernas were. Selva felt as if she had discovered a fascinating new world, with all its colors and cultures existing beyond her own narrow world. She became eager to learn more. One September afternoon, after leaving Sabiha and Majid at the Marquis Cafe, Rafo at last took Selva to his home. His parents were away at their summer house in Tarabya by the Bosphorus. The furniture in the drawing room was covered with dust sheets. The carpets were rolled up neatly against the walls. The crystal chandeliers were wrapped in newspaper. It was all rather dark. Selva sat on the edge of the covered sofa next to Rafo. He gently turned Selva's face toward him and kissed her. "Do you want to make love to me?" Selva asked, much to Rafo's surprise. "Rafo, I asked you a question."
"No, I don't know what you mean. Yes, no, I mean, what sort of question is that?"
"I think it was very clear. Yes or no?"
"You know I do, but I shouldn't. Of course. I mean, I didn't have that in mind when I kissed you."
"I didn't ask about your intention. I asked if you wanted to."
Selva, darling, you know I wouldn't do anything to hurt you.
You're not answering my question.
Rafo looked at her intensely, trying to figure out what she meant. Selva was waiting for an answer, her eyes wide open.
Yes, I do want to make love to you, very much.
Why?
Because I love you, of course.
Do you really love me?
Don't you know that?
You've never told me so.
Maybe because I haven't dared to.
Why's that?
I didn't want to make you angry.
How could I possibly be angry that you love me?
Well, I thought that you might think I was being audacious.
Fine, let's consider it said then, and as you can see, I'm not angry.
Rafo lowered his head and kissed her again.
Just imagine, Rafo, that even though you love me, you might end up getting married to someone else and making love to her. The same goes for me too, of course.
It is impossible to change your destiny, Selva.
Isn't it?
As Rafo lowered his head to kiss Selva for the third time, he suddenly realized that he was passing the reins of their fate into Selva's hands. They spent the rest of the day in that dark room until it was time to rejoin Sabiha. He hadn't managed to pluck up the courage to kiss her again. Selva had neither encouraged nor discouraged him. For his part, he couldn't decide whether or not his advances might have a negative effect. His mind and his feelings were in turmoil. He had had the desire to let her long blonde hair flow down her slender body, which he presumed was as smooth as velvet and as white as snow. But in the end, he had to make do with continuing their conversation, which was led by Selva. When the clock struck 6, announcing it was time to leave, she got up, swayed toward the door, and left the room without exchanging another kiss. They walked hand in hand down the marble steps of the house and onto the narrow streets of Pera. They took the metro from Tunel to Karaköy, where they met Sabiha at the pier before the two sisters took the boat back to the prince's islands.
"So what have you been doing today?" Sabiha asked.
Rafo was about to answer, but Selva interrupted him.
"We went to Rafo's home," she replied. "What? Was there anybody there?"
she asked, sounding surprised.
"No. So what were you up to then?"
"What do you do sitting at home?"
"We talked." "Goodness gracious, you two never stop talking. You could have gone to the cinema."
"We never run out of things to talk about,"
Selva said before turning to Rafo and kissing him goodbye on the cheek. Rafo was thrilled, as if a shock went straight from his cheek to his heart. It was something totally different from what he had felt when he kissed Selva on the lips. It was as though she was taking care of him. She was publicly acknowledging their relationship. Rafo felt an inexplicable warmth toward her as he walked to the bus stop for Tarabya. He felt proud. "Good Lord, she loves me," he thought to himself. "Mother, mother, Selva loves me." Rafo's mother, Rakela, was no longer as enthusiastic as she had been when Rafo first told her that he had been invited to Fazıl Reşat Pasha's house. At the time, she had felt very proud that one of her sons had befriended the daughter of one of the most prominent Turkish families. Her mother-in-law had been less excited.
"What's so special about that? Don't forget that your husband is an Alfandari."
Rakela would never have known what was going on if one of her friends hadn't told her about the gossip concerning her son. She had been having endless arguments with Raphael herself already. She believed him to be her most intelligent son. Later, his decision to leave the university came as a great shock. Raphael was unlike his brothers. He always had a mind of his own. He was the one who criticized his family for speaking Spanish Hebrew, Ladino, and not Turkish at home. He didn't see any sense in speaking the language of a country that had tortured and banished his people many years ago. Rakela presumed that her son's decision to leave university had something to do with that. But maybe he had gotten too emotional about an incident there and turned it into a matter of pride and honor. She'd noticed that her son had had bouts of depression ever since his father died. Did he feel guilty that he hadn't been able to help his father? No one in the family had realized how bad Salvador Alfandari's heart was until the night he had had that fatal heart attack. Rakela badgered her son with questions. Why was he studying chemistry if he found it so difficult? Why didn't he choose another subject at least? Why couldn't he take a sabbatical and continue with his studies the following year? When Rakela's friend Rosa visited her one evening, what she had to relate was typical of the gossip at the time. The story, of course, bore no resemblance to the facts. Rosa told Rakela that it was Fazıl Reşat Paşa who had had Rafael removed from the university because Rafo had the audacity to pester his daughter. That was the first time in her life that Rakela had cursed the Turks. The following day, she sought the assistance of all the family elders, whom Rafael loved and respected. She asked them to intervene and give him advice. She blamed herself for not having foreseen this catastrophe. Her darling son had abandoned his studies because of this despicable blonde devil in disguise. All those hopes and dreams she had had for her son. He was supposed to launch a range of lavender-based perfumes. She had discussed this project with a nephew in France, and he'd been preparing to market the products for them. Who knew? Maybe one day Rafael would become the owner of his very own perfumery. Even names had been discussed. Les Nuits du Bosphore, or Essence d'Orient for the ladies' range, or Raf for the men's products. When she finally confronted her son about Selva, she received yet another blow. Rafo had gone as far as discussing the possibility of marrying her. Rakela's dismay at Rafo's academic underachievement was nothing in comparison to the thought that he was considering marrying a Muslim girl. That year, the Passover meant nothing to Rakela. She hadn't bothered to bring down and wash her precious piñatas from the attic. She couldn't bring herself to prepare the special celebration meal of pescado con huevos y limones. She didn't even supervise the making of the matzo. The rest of the family didn't feel much better. Every single person had tried to dissuade Rafo from taking this step. Each had either chastised him or tried to advise him, some even resorting to emotional blackmail. Rafo began to think that he was lucky that his father had died 2 years previously. He shuddered to think how he would have reacted. The only person to adopt a totally different approach was his Uncle Jack. "Every cloud has a silver lining," he said to his elder sister Rakela. "Just think of the advantages should your son become Fazıl Reşat Paşa's son-in-law. Instead of wishing that your son would leave this girl, you should be praying that he is accepted into such a family." Rafa had not been accepted by the Pasha, and Selva had not changed her mind. And yet, Rafo had not been able to express his fears for their future. Was what they were about to do madness? At first he thought that the fire inside him would cool, or that Selva would be persuaded to change her mind. But Selva had no such intention. She wasn't giving him up, nor did he have the nerve to stop himself. He was proud to be so loved by this girl he admired so much, and there was also the excitement of tasting forbidden fruit. Many of his friends looked upon him with envy, as if he were the hero in a fairy tale. Unfortunately, his relatives, particularly his mother, did not share this view. Rakela did not give up.
"One would think you were Aladdin in love with the Sultan's daughter," she said, crying her eyes out. "Can't you see they don't even deign to speak to us? All we hear about is how angry and disappointed the Pasha and his wife are. What about me? What about my family, for God's sake? One would think that we are enamored of that beanpole. How heartbroken and ashamed we are! Where is your dignity?
Raphael did indeed have dignity, and that was precisely why he couldn't give Selva up. Selva still believed that eventually both families would come around to accepting the situation, especially after they had children. Raphael, on the other hand, knew very well that if their child was brought up as a Muslim, his family would never forgive him. Likewise, if the child was brought up as a Jew, Selva's family would never forgive her.
"Time will heal everything," Selva said. "They are bound to miss us when we live abroad. Surely they will mellow when they see how solid our relationship is. Leave it to time."
Rafo envisaged all sorts of scenarios in his mind. He knew they'd have financial problems, as well as difficulties adapting to a foreign country. He knew that they would be lonely, too, at times. But he'd never imagined the hell they were suffering these days. It was all beyond his worst dreams. Here he was, in Marseille, without a valid passport, an apprentice, even though he had paid to become a partner. He was truly pitiful. Afraid to have his son circumcised and in a position where at any time he might be dragged away from his wife and child and sent to a labor camp. He was risking a death sentence even though he had committed no crime. He could be sent to the gallows without a trial. Yes, he had foreseen problems, but nothing of this magnitude. These were the thoughts going through Rotho's mind as he perched among the cardboard boxes in the pharmacy's storeroom. Waiting for the commotion outside to calm down, he couldn't help cursing his fate. How long he awkwardly sat there in the dark waiting for the all-clear he didn't know, but when he tried to get up, he realized he had strained his back.
"They're gone," said Benoit. "You can come out now. I don't think they're coming back." "Why won't you go to the Turkish consulate? If I were you, I would have gone ages ago."
The light outside blinded Rafo, and he rubbed his eyes, squinting.
"You're really obsessed with this idea," he said. "I promise you, I have heard from various sources that those with Turkish passports can save their skins."
"Don't believe everything you hear," Rafo said, rubbing his back.
"I swear it's true. Why do you think the lines outside the consulate are getting longer every day?"
"Those are lines of people who left Turkey after the First World War. In fact, we have friends among them. My situation isn't the same."
"Rafo, most of them got their French nationality. They gave up their Turkish citizenship years ago. Now they are lining up for days on end for their Turkish passports again."
"Where did you learn all this from, Beno? You have your French nationality. Nobody knows that your mother was Jewish. So what's all this to you?"
"I've made inquiries on your behalf. One of the consulate employees is my aunt's tenant. The other day when I went to see her, he came to pay his rent. He's a very nice man. He speaks French. We had a cup of coffee together."
"So?"
"I mentioned you." "Oh, for God's sake, don't get on your high horse. I didn't give him your name. I simply said that I had a friend from Istanbul with a residence permit who hasn't applied for citizenship yet. 'Let him come,' he said. 'Even if his Turkish passport has expired, we can immediately extend it.'"
"I don't believe this."
"I swear that's what he said."
"You're joking."
"Rafo, I'm telling you the truth. If you have doubts, why not let your wife apply on your behalf?"
"I've told Selva to leave and go back to Istanbul, but she won't listen. She'll never go back on her word, so a Turkish passport won't solve our problem."
"It certainly will, Rafo, I'm telling you."
"How?"
"Well, I don't really know. Maybe the Turks have some kind of agreement with the Germans. Maybe they are allies. How the hell do I know? I'm a chemist, not a diplomat."
"Nonsense," said Rafo.
"The Turks would never take the German side."
"Why not? Didn't they in the First World War?"
Rafo felt like saying,
"They certainly did, but what a mistake that was."
He kept quiet. He stretched to ease his back, trying to change the subject.
"Let's get out of here.
I've been stuck in this cramped place for hours.
Just 23 minutes?
Benoit replied.
23 minutes, it feels like 23 hours.
They walked downstairs from the storeroom to the pharmacy, Rafo still rubbing his back. An old man entered the shop.
Welcome, said Rafo.
The man didn't say a word.
What can I do for you, monsieur?
I don't really know. Actually, there's nothing I wanted. I'll have an aspirin, please. Yes, just an aspirin.
Monsieur, you're shaking. Are you all right? Would you like to sit down?
Benoit offered the man a chair from behind the counter.
Sit over here, relax, he said.
The old man sat down, put his elbows on his knees, and cradled his head in his hands. He was shaking visibly.
Epilepsy?
Rafo whispered to Benoit.
No, he's crying.
The two friends looked at each other.
Would you like some water? Maybe a sedative?
The old man shook his head and continued crying for a while before straightening up.
I want my dignity back, gentlemen, he said. Nothing else. Neither water nor medicine.
These are hard days for everyone, Benoit said. Life isn't easy for any of us.
You know this decrepit old man, Pétain, the conspirator, the traitor. Once I used to admire him. I thought he was a hero. I even had a framed photograph of him on my desk. I wish I'd known then what I know now.
Marshal Pétain believes he is protecting the French. If he hadn't cooperated, the invasion forces would have reached us here,
Benoit said softly.
Would that be better?
My dear boy, two-faced Pétain isn't capable of stopping them coming south. Don't kid yourself. They'll be here soon enough. When that day dawns, we'll be doomed, you'll see. When that day comes, we'll lose everything. This Vichy government has taken over and we've lost everything anyway, including our dignity.
Benoit looked around anxiously.
You're distressed, monsieur. Don't talk this way. Someone might hear.
Just now they stopped a man walking 2 paces in front of me. They asked for his identity papers. Apparently he didn't have them. They started to manhandle him, and he resisted. Then they dragged him into their jeep. Can you guess what they did then? Do you by any chance know how they check if you are Jewish? Luckily, I am all skin and bone, so I was able to hide behind a big tree. I ran and ran all the way down the street from tree to tree to get away from them. I haven't run that way for at least 15 years. I ducked into every street. I even pissed myself. Look, I didn't have my identity papers with me either. I had to run away, otherwise I would have had to show my penis to those bastards who called themselves policemen. I ran away. And why am I running away, son? I'm not a thief. I'm not a murderer. I'm not guilty of anything. I'm 82 years old. I haven't got the strength anymore. I can't keep running away.
Rafo pretended not to notice the wet stain on the front of the man's pants.
Give me some sleeping pills!
I can't sell those without a prescription, said Benoit.
You'd better get one from your doctor.
I haven't got a doctor. He left. Those who were intelligent and young left. The trash stayed behind. We couldn't make it. Why don't you be a good boy and give me some sleeping pills?
Rafo took 2 pills from a box and gave them to the man.
This will do for you tonight. You should get a good night's sleep, he said, refusing to accept payment.
The old man got up, put the 2 pills in his pocket, and staggered out. He came back immediately looking very confused.
Gentlemen, where am I now? I don't think I recognize this district. I'm sure I visited a friend in a hospital in that square, but I don't know my way around. Is there a bus stop near here?
Benoit went outside with the old man. Let me show you the way. When Benoit returned, Rafa was sulking.
We could have done without harboring that damned informer, he said.
For heaven's sake, Rafa, do me a favor and stop talking like that. Even walls have ears nowadays. You could get us both into trouble if you carry on like that. That poor old man had nothing to lose. Didn't you see? He wouldn't have been so outspoken if he'd been 15 years younger.
Was he telling the truth, Beno? Is it possible the police have stooped that low?
I honestly don't know. I don't think so. He was probably exaggerating.
I might go to the Turkish consulate after all. If I'm going to be messed and shoved around, I can do that just as well back home.
Come on, Rafa. You wouldn't be shoved around there. Many German Jews escaped to Turkey. There is a cousin of mine on my mother's side, Leon Arndt, and a very close family friend, Auerbach. Both managed to get away and are now teaching chemistry at the Istanbul University. Do it, Rafa. Get up and go before it's too late. Forget about your pride. You owe it to your wife and child.
It just isn't a matter of pride. If that were the case, I wouldn't have come all the way here. Do you know what would be ahead for me? For a start, my son. Will he be Jewish or Muslim? Whichever we choose will cause outrage. Our families and friends won't want to know us. It isn't as bad feeling lonely in a country where you don't know anyone. Can you imagine being ignored by everyone in a place where you have many friends and family? My father-in-law doesn't even want to know his daughter. As for my family, can you imagine? They no longer set my place for Passover. Why do you think we came all the way here?
Yes, I understand, said Benno. It must be difficult, very difficult. But as I said before, no one's situation is easy these days. We all seem to live in some kind of hell or other.
Rafa didn't reply. He was standing in the doorway watching the bent old man stumbling down the street, still trembling visibly. Ankara, 1941. As Macit walked home from the ministry, he was happy that he had things to relate to his father-in-law over their raki. He and the old man had been living under the same roof for some time now, and Macit had grown to like Fazıl Reşat Paşa. At first he was rather nervous of this elderly Ottoman gentleman who still dressed in the old style, but the Pasha had adapted well to the new republic. Whether intentionally or not, he had gradually relaxed with Macit and begun to reveal his weaknesses. In spite of all his progressive ideas, the Pasha hadn't been able to come to terms with the collapse of the empire and the fact that the Sultan had been forced to run away. As far as he was concerned, the War of Liberation ought to have been fought under the Sultan's banner. If a change was necessary, maybe the Sultan ought to have been changed, but not the regime. People living on Ottoman soil weren't as cultured as the Europeans. They didn't have the know-how to govern themselves. They could only be governed by a leader like a sultan or a padishah, who also had religious authority. Whenever the old man spoke, he deliberately avoided mentioning the republic, preferring instead to use words like Ottoman, Ottoman soil, or Ottoman administrators. Like most of the Ottoman pashas, Fazıl Reşat was a well-educated man who hated fanatics. He believed that reactionaries were destroying his country. All the same, he was against being governed by those without religious authority. He was particularly against being ruled by the people. Macit considered these ideas nonsensical, but always listened quietly, respectfully, refraining from making comments. He could never understand how a cultured person, who had adapted so well to modern living, could go on and on about the importance of a sultan. Although Fazıl Reşat Paşa was an advocate of a sultan, he was also a man who had an accurate understanding of most things, and enjoyed life to the full. Every evening he would wait for Majid, sitting beside a small table with a selection of mezes that he had prepared himself. Together they would sit on their stools in the small hallway between the kitchen and dining room, chatting about the day's developments, sipping ice-cold raki, and nibbling on white cheese and roasted chickpeas. Majid was certain that the Pasha chose this small corridor so that the ladies of the house couldn't join them. It was obvious that, after spending all day with his wife, daughter, and grandchild, listening to women talk, in the evening the poor man needed a change. Fazl Reshat Pasha always listened attentively to Majid and often made some unexpectedly incisive comments. For example, he was certain that getting involved with the Germans would have disastrous results. As far as he was concerned, it was the Germans who somehow always managed to stir up trouble in the world. Although he never mentioned Selva and Rafo, he was furious about the atrocities the Germans were inflicting on the Jews. He was sure that one day history would judge them, and they would have to pay for their injustices. Majid couldn't understand how such a wise man was unable to find it in his heart to forgive his young daughter. Today, the Pasha had prepared their raki on the marble kitchen counter. They picked up their glasses and began to sip.
"A very important development took place today, sir," said Majid. "The British ambassador delivered a letter to President Inonu."
"Really? And what do they want?"
"They want two things. The first is, they definitely want us to sign an agreement with the Russians."
"Surely not."
"As a matter of fact, we have been putting that one on the back burner for some time. The other thing is something we've hoped for, even though it seems negative. Because, in the present circumstances, we are so isolated, both geographically and strategically, it appears that the British won't be able to come to our aid if we're attacked."
"Well, well, just listen to them. We are expected to run to their rescue, but they won't do the same for us. Doesn't still water run deep? They have certainly mastered the art of backstabbing."
"Actually, we are rather happy about this, sir. They say that since they are in no position to help us, they'd consider it sensible if we should contact the Germans, making sure we at least eliminate the danger of an attack."
"You don't say. In other words, our president, the deaf old fox, has solved the problem just by being patient."
Majid stifled a laugh. "Inonu may have trouble hearing, sir, but he has a good brain. Now that Hitler has attacked Russia, he has finally relaxed a bit. Do you know that when they telephoned and woke him up in the early hours to tell him of Hitler invading Russia, he burst into laughter and couldn't stop? Can you believe the brilliance of Inonu's plan? Had we sided with the British, we'd now be face to face with Mr. Hitler. The way things are, we neither sided with the British nor the Germans, and we avoided becoming either's enemy. On top of that, the British are encouraging us to have good relations with the Germans."
"So, how did the British come to this brilliant decision?"
"It's the only way to stop the Germans invading Turkey. Of course, there is another thing."
"What's that?"
"We are to inform the British of the details of our negotiations in writing and act outside these parameters."
"Do you know, my son,"
said the Pasha in a trembling voice,
"I just can't stomach the fact that damned foreigners are dictating what we should do. Would the great Ottoman have stooped to this?"
"But, sir, wasn't it the same before the Republic? How on earth were we supposed to equip our forces when we inherited a crushing gold debt from the Ottomans? Didn't we need charity from the British?"
"I'm not defending the Ottomans, my son. I am aware of all our mistakes, but it still hurts."
"They are not your mistakes, sir. They are mistakes that have accumulated over the centuries. Please, God, let us pave the way to a stronger and wealthier nation for our children."
"Yes, we have certainly made a mess of things. Inshallah, you will succeed."
Fazul Reshat Pasha said sadly. I do understand how you feel, sir, but believe me, Inonu is doing his best to protect our country's honor. I know because I deal with Hitler's correspondence. The Germans sent us a friendly letter back in February,